From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The White House recently published a press release from its science office that claimed President Donald Trump was responsible for, quote, ending the COVID-19 pandemic, and that he has, quote, taken decisive actions to engage scientists and health professionals in academia, industry, and government to understand, treat, and defeat the disease. The statement would have been true if we lived in an alternate universe in which Trump wasn't president. The U.S. is now seeing 50 to 80,000 new cases of the virus each day, and that number could rise alarmingly to 100,000 a day as we head into the winter months. But if Trump's version of history holds, we'll have disappeared the virus this past summer. The nation will have turned a corner on the pandemic every other week, and a vaccine would be miraculously appearing across the country by election day. The true history of the COVID-19 pandemic is already being documented, and one book wants to set the record straight right from the start. My guest is John Sternfeld. He is a writer and editor of the new book, Unprepared: America in the Time of Coronavirus. Welcome to the program, John.
Thank you for having me, Sonali.
So first, how do you share this history? This is a pandemic of historic proportions, and it's something that we are still in the middle of. In fact, some indicate that we may not have even reached the peak and that the worst is yet to come. So is this a history of the start of the pandemic?
Well, it's the first 6 months of it. And the idea was to record the history as it was happening. My editor and I noticed that even the day things had happened, there was already some kind of battle over what was true, what wasn't true. And we thought a historical document that kept track of who said what which day would become valuable. It expanded over 6 months, but there were days where I was writing the book as things were happening. And with each day, I found even putting the book together a valuable resource just to keep track of who, what, when. And as we look back from January to June, every problem we're dealing with now happened during then. So what I see since July has been a repetition of the exact same sequence of events. This battle over masks is still going on. The battle over testing is still going on. So I think of the framework of the first 6 months kind of being implanted and repeated over and over again.
One of the documents or sort of fact sources that you repeatedly bring up in your book is the Johns Hopkins Coronavirus Resource Center. As a journalist, I have also repeatedly referred to this resource. Tell me about this and why it's part of the book and why it's important to have this non-governmental documentation of how the virus has been changing and spreading.
I think you'd agree, before the pandemic even started, we were living during a very strange time where the White House's communication itself was no longer trustworthy. Whether that was misinformation or disinformation, the fact is that other outlets, academic outlets, private outlets, had to become the sort of steady baseline that gave us a sense of what was going on. When we first started putting the book together, we began with President Trump's words, and then the governor's words, Governor Cuomo in my state. And as we added more and more governors and more mayors, we realized that there were too many aspects of the book that weren't true, right? We couldn't write a book where I just included politicians I agreed with. So we started including governor of Texas, governor of Georgia. And I looked up and I said to my editor, you know, there's too many lies in this book. So what we had to do is go to these sort of respected institutions that were sort of hovering there day after day counting. Johns Hopkins was one of the first ones, and then the COVID tracking project at The Atlantic. Because without these numbers sort of keeping our minds focused on the data, you could get lost because the entire pandemic was being spun by the White House for its own reasons, as we know.
Of course, having a president who went into this pandemic showing a disdain for science, I suppose we shouldn't have been terribly surprised about how things turned out. Maybe there were some people who thought, well, maybe now is when he'll turn things over to scientists. And during the debates ahead of the election, we've seen, and even during interviews, we've seen Trump try to backtrack on some of his most fantastical claims. And I want to address one of them. There was this moment this past year when Trump, just said in seriousness, and we know that he was serious because most of us watched the White House Coronavirus Task Force, where he said, where he asked scientists to research whether disinfectant taken internally could help eradicate the virus and how sunlight simply kills it, and is there a way to get UV rays in. So that moment, now Trump has sort of backtracked on that and tried to claim, well, he was just joking. How does this book, where you try to examine this history, tackle these incredible moments that seem like they're coming out of, a parody, and that the Trump is trying to rewrite that history now? How do you take those on?
Well, I remember when that happened, and in the book, when we hit that day, it actually went on into the next morning. You have commentary from various health officials, governors, and mayors responding to it. So that was one of those moments in the book that rippled outwards for a few days. People were saying, I can't believe I have to say this, but do not inject bleach. But I think you point to something that's sort of malevolent and manipulative about the president, is that he knows his audience is not going to see that video over and over and over again. They definitely heard about the bleach thing, but their networks and their apparatus are not showing the video of that happening. And Anthony Fauci or Dr. Birx or whoever it was that day, sort of putting their face down in their hands, because obviously he was serious. So he operates from a place where his version of events will be sold to his audience. The best thing the book could do is report what was. Report how people reacted after the fact. Now, if Trump was joking, you would have heard him saying, I was joking the next day. But that joke line only came about recently. He only started saying, I was being sarcastic about a month ago. And a lot of that is because his audience, his followers, will not see that video. They won't even seek it out. So he's protected in a way.
So you put a sort of a timeline of relevant quotes, one after the other, of US officials, of fact-based documents, of the kinds, of state governors, to paint a picture of how things unfolded in those first 6 months. And you mentioned earlier that you're seeing some patterns again. So here we are, about to enter the winter months, and the country is still not convinced that wearing protective face coverings would save lives, even though there have been respected scientific models showing that if we had universal mask wearing, we might save tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of lives. So what, how has that message around masks played out over the first 6 months of this pandemic?
It's really been really amazing. The masks issue, which we all remember in February and early March, it did sound strange to wear masks. I don't think anybody can be condemned for back then being suspicious. And even Dr. Fauci said in very early March, he made this one comment where he said, the masks right now are being reserved for health officials, right? So that was the one comment he made that has been used to this day by the president as proof that the mask thing is up in the air, when obviously the mask thing is not up in the air. What's shocking, if you read the book, is you see the politicization of it happening in real time. Obviously, there's nothing political about covering your face, right? However, what you see in March early on is the president was against it. So then his health officials had to be a little more careful in the way they addressed it. Then the governors and mayors that are like sort of Trump wannabes, let's call them, they were against masks. So now 6 months later, it almost seems obvious. Oh yeah, masks, that's a liberal idea. But if you go to the book on March 10th, masks were just this strange, interesting thing we might have to habituate to. Now it's become sort of a symbol, but not because of anything natural. All right. I think that's important, that when people say masks have become political, the president has made the masks political, right? He made it political during that trip to the factory in Michigan. The vice president made it political at the Mayo Clinic. These are all things that happened back in May. So now we're living in an environment where people are needlessly dying because the president doesn't want to wear a mask. And he doesn't want people walking around in a mask. It's really all there is to it.
And of course, he himself caught the virus, and taking his cue of not wearing masks, it seems as though the entire White House turned into a hotspot, because really very few people apparently within the White House staff wear masks, in a way following the president's cue. So masks is one aspect. What about testing? Testing is another thing that there's been so much misinformation over, especially from the government and especially from President Trump. At various times, he's claimed that anybody can get a test if they want to, even in the very early days when tests were not widely available. He's left it to the governors. And then he has, of course, bizarrely claimed that the reason why there are so many cases observed in the U.S. is because we're apparently testing too much. So how do you follow this thread in the first 6 months?
It really is. There's something kind of... if there wasn't so much sickness and death, it would be farcical, because the idea that the testing alone is reflective of the numbers is not true, obviously, because the hospitalizations and the deaths are following in line. The only thing I can think of is that early on, Trump was not involved in the details of the pandemic. You could see it from all his statements in March and April. He really didn't know what was going on. I think when he said anybody who wants to get a test can get a test, I think the first time he said that, he actually thought that. Then somebody explained to him that it wasn't true, but then he couldn't admit he was wrong. So what you have is this constant cycle of chasing the lie about our numbers are so high because of tests. Well, that's a way for Trump to be able to brag, we are the best at testing, while also denying the failures, which is we have more people dying than anywhere else. So it's like the entire government communication apparatus is designed to cover his mistakes and to make sure he looks good. So now we have 10 months later where people don't understand how to read the basic charts about deaths and hospitalizations. They're going to take him at his word for it. I mean, we're talking about 40 to 50 million people that are going to vote for Trump that believe he's handled the pandemic well. And in order to believe that, this is just a factual statement, you are not in touch with the data. You just can't be. There's just no way. So I feel like when this is all over, there's a larger cancerous problem about the news in American society and what can we do about it, and whether or not there's a way to reteach people how to recognize news. I think the damage that Trump has done on just science itself has been very long lasting.
I'm so glad you brought that up, and that's very much the heart of so much of what has happened around the coronavirus. Staying on the testing for a bit, though, wasn't there this whole lost month early on in the pandemic when it turned out that the testing, the U.S. labs that were called upon to develop a test were given flawed information from the government? And they could have gone to the protocol that the World Health Organization was sharing with other nations. And then, of course, the World Health Organization became the favorite bogeyman for Trump. And I'm wondering if that whole demonization of the WHO was part of this attempt to cover up the tracks and to cover up the lies around the U.S.'s own testing failures very early on when the virus really went out of control because nobody was testing as cases were spreading across the country.
Yeah, that's true. The original test, and there was a great Frontline documentary on this. I watched it while it was happening. Essentially, the test had a faulty agent in it. So that first 4 or 5 weeks, the test itself was useless, basically. And it took a while for us to recognize it. And then we also stubbornly refused to join on board with the WHO. How much of that came with Trump is probably obvious, because early on, Trump was able to demonize the WHO. Now, I did not put this book together with an agenda, but you'll see early on, the WHO was very much on top of the issue. Yes, they didn't want people to panic, but their involvement was extremely cautious. They were focused on the data. There was no point where they were hiding. Perhaps the Chinese were not as honest with the WHO as possible. But this idea that China and the WHO are responsible for our failures in late October is just propaganda. So the failures happened at the testing level, they happened at the messaging level, and then they happened at the level where America for the past 4 years has no longer become an honest partner with the rest of the world. This predates the pandemic, obviously. It predates the Paris Climate Accords. But there's been a message from this White House that we don't need other countries. Well, obviously during international pandemic, we absolutely need other countries. But because that is Trump's image, everything serves the image. You know, it's almost Stalin-esque in the way I describe it, in that everything feeds back into the idea that Trump can solve it alone. So we don't need the WHO. Obviously, if we had banded together with those other countries and intergovernmental organizations, our test would have reached cities in America much quicker. And absolutely, there would have been much less death early on.
So that I imagine that President Xi Jinping of China being demonized along with the entire nation of China, as Trump, of course, began then referring to the coronavirus as the China virus or the Chinese virus, that's all part of the same trend, right? You demonize everybody else because only Trump is the savior, can save the nation. So that's part one of the question. Part two is, did he do that also to governors, especially Democratic governors like Andrew Cuomo and Gavin Newsom?
I read recently that Jared Kushner actually admitted to Bob Woodward that the idea was for Trump to push things off on governors so he would never have to take the fall for the failure. Now, it was shocking that Jared Kushner is dumb enough to have said this aloud, but he did. And I don't think anybody that's been following the pandemic is surprised, right? Trump was able to claim credit for the China ban, which, if you look in the book, was not a ban, and which was not that effective. But also he was then able to push off responsibility. So by saying it's up to the states, he was able to make it like this was a bureaucratic fight. But really, when you have a pandemic, you cannot have 50 individual governors bidding for PPE.
And wasn't it Kushner also who said that the federal stockpile of PPE and other medical equipment was not for the states, as if there are some other people living elsewhere in the country?
Exactly.
Only the federal government.
Right. So after he was able to blame the states, he then saw a political opening where the spikes were going on in blue states or blue cities. And I use both of those in quotes. So he was able to put it on not just states, but Democratic states and Democratic governors and cities. And he was able to demonize the victims of the virus itself. And I think once he did that, there was no turning back. This was never going to become a communal unified response. It was going to be an us versus them. And ironically, even though the red states, again, I use it in quotes, are spiking now, he still leads into that language because it allows the pandemic to become this political cudgel, which I really think is the only thing he understands, to be honest, about how to operate, right? It's like allies and enemies, and that's it. There's no other mode for him, and that's why people are suffering.
When the White House Science Office said that Trump had taken decisive actions to engage scientists and health professionals, it was really so bizarre to read that. So there's three sort of main scientific experts that we've seen over the past 6 months that have become now household names: Dr. Deborah Birx, Dr. Robert Redfield, head of the CDC, and of course Dr. Anthony Fauci, who is the infectious diseases expert in the nation. Of those three, Fauci seems to be the most trustworthy. But from writing that history of those first 6 months of the pandemic, where do you stand on these three scientists who sometimes have said, you know, Birx and Redfield have sometimes said the right things and sometimes not?
Yeah, I think you're being too kind. I think Dr. Birx had an opportunity early on when she had the president's ear, where she chose not to stand up to them. And I use stand up to them in a broad sense. There was a quote she gave, which is in the book, about how well Trump understood the medical information. And she gave this long fawning answer about, you've never seen anybody who understood the scientific literature like this guy. And the second I heard that, I was like, uh-oh. And since then, she has decided to value her closeness to the president in favor of public health. Now, in August, she did come out, but I felt it was far too late. Same things with Dr. Redfield. Dr. Redfield was next to Trump on March 6th during the CDC visit when he was attacking Governor Inslee of the state of Washington, which had the first case. And immediately Redfield realized he was in the midst of sort of political fire, and he could have, like Fauci, just sort of repeated the line, but he didn't. He sort of hid behind Trump. He made sure everything he said was taken okay by Trump. I thought he was kind of an embarrassment in some of the House hearings, which we have quotes from. So I do think Fauci is the only one who has committed himself to the science, who knows that there are millions of people, Trump followers, who call for his firing. Apparently he's gotten death threats. He's the only one who's been brave enough to speak up to this president from the beginning.
So it seems as though, I mean, I know I've said this to myself, but I don't know if this is the place that you've arrived at, which is that if there is a vaccine in the future, because unfortunately Trump has entirely politicized the development of a vaccine, which we all absolutely desperately need. But if there is a vaccine, at least my standard has been, if Dr. Anthony Fauci says it's safe and that he will take it, I would take it. Did you arrive at that conclusion writing this book as well?
Yeah, and it's strange because if you study Fauci's history, you know, he's been around since the AIDS virus. He's sort of been like the competent, straightforward bureaucrat. He is really the only trustworthy person in this entire administration, which is saying something. A presidential administration is gigantic. But I don't think there's any other figure who has the same trust, at least on the anti-Trump side of the equation, as Fauci. I do hope he sticks around through the vaccine. It seems like in the press, he's leaking sort of disgruntled quotes, and that makes me worry that he's going to leave. But I don't think if he leaves, there's anybody that I would be able to trust to put this vaccine into myself, into my wife, into my children. It's terrifying that we're reached this point. But I think Fauci knows he's that thread, and that's why he's staying.
So let's finally pick up on what you mentioned earlier, which is that this history is one that you have put together because the ultimate battle is over truth and journalism and a trust in journalism. I mean, a democracy functions best when there is an independent, and vibrant journalistic industry that can hold powerful elites to their word, that can light a fire under them, that can report accurately. And we've had this huge drop off in trust from the public because it's hard for some sectors of the public to just know who to trust when you have a president who repeatedly says that the press is the enemy of the people. And you, depending upon which outlet you tune into, you might see a completely different reality. So going forward, when it comes to an issue like the pandemic, where you have to be able to say, okay, this is a fact and this is fiction, are you worried for the future of our nation?
I am. You know, it's funny to say that the pandemic is sort of the first wave, but when this pandemic hopefully settles down, we have to address the anti-science bias in this country. It is literally killing us. It is infecting our news. It's not just Trump. Trump was able to wrestle something about the way the news apparatus in this country works into his control. It's why he's able to lie so freely, is because he knows he has an apparatus that will take care of him. My concern is, I think about my kids, I have young kids, are they learning how to distinguish real from fake? I mean, 20 years from now, the amount of fake news is going to be so much larger. There's going to be fake videos that are going to be impossible to tell the difference from. So I worry that if this nation doesn't educate people on how to read news, read charts, understand facts.
John, thank you so much for joining us today and good luck with the book.
Thank you, Sonali. Thank you for having me.
My guest has been John Sternfeld. He's a writer and the editor of the book we've just been discussing, Unprepared: America in the Time of Coronavirus. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.